that we've been looking for a while at the idea of the process of working on oneself. Right? We said that these 49 days that we're going through now are a system of self-development. That means from the mystical point of view, there are 49 stages of work that a person can do on him or herself. Last week we went through the week that represents finality. In other words, when a job is being done, there's a certain stage in the mystical world when the thing's complete, it just hasn't been revealed yet. Right? The inner work is being done. The mystics say that it's the formation of the seed. When a father or a mother is producing, when the body is producing the seed that will be a child, so then there is a stage when the seed is complete, it just hasn't come out and been given yet. So you don't have a revelation in the world. In fact, it's still a complete secret. There's no child born. But the work's been done. The happiness of that time is that if the perfection has been achieved now, then nothing else will go wrong. Once the seed is found, there can be no mistake. It may not be revealed or revealed correctly. That kind of problem can happen. But intrinsically, the thing is perfect. That's the happiness of the fifth week of the 7 weeks. And that's why the happiest day is the fifth of the fifth day. Because 5 out of 7, which we won't go into now exactly why, but the fifth of 7 stages is always the one where the inner work has been done. The next 2 stages, the sixth and the seventh, are simply the stage of giving over of the seed, which actually doesn't change it at all. No more building has to be done. And the seventh is the stage when the seed is already revealed on the outside. And now it becomes a child or whatever's been revealed in the world. Of course, those are very important. But Rav Shimon Bar Yochai could die on the day when the inner work had been done. Of course, that's why he was the great mystic. He brought to the world the Zohar, the great mystical work. Now, what we want to understand is the following thing. And I think this is an important subject because of a few reasons. One is questions that have been asked, by people who have certain sufferings, and the other reason is because so many people are going through such suffering. And that question is, what's a Jew supposed to do in failure? Now, what happens if you got to that stage and you didn't make it? What happens if you got to that fifth stage and now what's happening is what was born inwardly is being given out and it's going to be revealed and born and you didn't get it right? So now all you have is the depression and the fear and the anxiety that will be associated with being revealed what you really are, which is really the big anxiety. That's what will happen in the next world. When a person is transitioning, let's put it bluntly, when a person is transitioning through the sixth of the 7 stages that are a person's life. Can't you find a seat? I'm not going to stand there the whole evening. I might talk for hours. When a person is transitioning from this world to the next, and they're going through that tunnel, which is the sixth of the 7 stages, right before the light is revealed, which is the seventh. So there'll be enormous agony and power of emotions that will be associated with that time. You know that what's about to be revealed is who you are. To yourself, that's the most agonizing. To Hashem. To everybody else you ever knew. And you're about to be revealed. And you know that you didn't get the job right. You aren't what you should be. And that's about to be revealed. What are you supposed to do then? The practical, unfortunately, this generation, that's who we are. We are, that's who we are. We're the tail end of Jewish history. And that we know that at the maximum, according to the mystical and revealed Jewish calculation, there are only 249 odd years left that the world could exist in this form before the final revelation must occur. Right? 6,000 years, we're in 5751 now. And we haven't gotten it right yet. When we failed miserably, if any generation failed, that's we. And the majority of Jewish people don't even know what it means to be Jewish at all. Never mind that they wouldn't die for it anymore, as Jews always did. But this generation is hopelessly, almost hopelessly lost. What are we supposed to do in this situation? And on an individual level, it doesn't take much to see, as we discussed briefly under the heading of the subject of laughter, which is the most ironic and bitterest subject that there is, that there could be any laughter in a world as bitter as this. it doesn't take much sensitivity to see that even if you happen to be more or less okay, which I sincerely doubt, then you at least have a friend, if not a close relative, if not a very close relative, who's not all right, whose at least marriage is in ruins, at least that, or who doesn't have a child who's seriously disturbed. And even if not, but somebody just knowing that there are people out there, even if it doesn't impinge on your life directly, there's tremendous misery going on out there, so great that anybody with any sensitivity at all, impossible to understand how anybody could go out and enjoy themselves. Right. And actually very insensitive. I actually noticed when I personally became close with my teacher, one of the greatest men of this generation, I happened to notice that he had an unusual way of greeting people. It struck me in the beginning. And the more I spent time with him, the more I realized that that was a conscious thing. In Hebrew, I've never really spoken to him in English. In Hebrew, you know, the custom is, and people say, how are you? People say, Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem means the bracha, blessing Hashem, things are okay. It means fine, that's what it means. How are you? Fine. That's what it means, Baruch Hashem. You're acknowledging Hashem's presence by giving, by expressing that bracha, but it means fine. He never said that. I never heard him say that. He always used to say, Zolzayin, good, it'll be fine. Or Metzapim Lishua, we are waiting for the redemption. I used to think it was like he's a very formal individual, but I used to think that was really poetic. And people said, how are you? He said, Metzapim Lishua, awaiting the redemption. I didn't know how to exactly understand those words. They're a very down-to-earth person. And I never heard, and I understood after a while, that somebody whose consciousness is great enough, who can feel the suffering, can feel what's happening, who can feel the pain of what the Jewish people are going through right now, what the world's going through, but our problem is us first and foremost. So somebody who's functioning on that level, how can you expect him to say that things are fine? What do you mean things are fine? What kind of a selfish, narrow attitude do you have that when somebody says, how are things, right? How are you? How are things? You say, fine? What about your neighbor? And what about everybody around you who's collapsing? What about the people who are in emotional agony right now? The majority of the Jewish people, estranged from what they should know, from even the most basic beginnings of what they should know. In human terms, never mind religious terms, just in human terms, how many people are really making it in a basic way? Even marriages that seem to the outside to be holding together, most times are very bitter, very bitter affairs. That's what we've come to. So let's see if we can achieve the ultimate irony of trying to extract the happiness, or trying to extract the glory and the dignity that there should be in that kind of experience, right? That kind of failure. What is the Torah attitude towards that kind of difficulty, or towards personal failure? What should a person do? What's the anatomy of that experience, and what should one do? And we all need this. That's exactly what we need now. If you think that you don't have this problem, then you really have failed. If you think that you're part of a social circle or a family circle or whatever it is that really has made it, that you're really expressing your potential in the world, that you're really who you should be, and you're really built up a positivity around you, that the vibes of which go out and are uplifting the Jewish people and humankind in general, that's what you think, you need to see somebody from another profession. That's not the case. That's not the case. That's not the case. One of the biggest sadnesses is the fact that exactly where the purity should be is the most scorned place on earth. If you want to look at it on a broader scale, in Israel, which is where all things are taken more sharply and where you have the beginning of every movement, you have right now a movement that looks with the most utter disgust and disdain on people who are involved in Torah. I don't know if you know that. Right now in Israel, the emotion is that anybody who is involved in Torah study, which is the pinnacle of the Jewish people, the most idealistic, people who have given their lives for idealism, people who are starving in order to learn Torah, right, which is exactly what we are, what millions and millions of Jews have died for that value. Yeah. In Israel today, that is considered to be the most disgusting, parasitic, low form of life. Recently, one of the religious newspapers quoted a non-religious newspaper that stated openly and categorically that the segment of the population that's involved in Torah study is the most despicable and causing the most derision and despicable element in society right now. Openly stated without any fear of even hurting or embarrassing anybody. That's what the Jewish people have come to right now. Now let's see what we can extract from this. It's worth thinking about very deeply, thinking into this subject, because you'll see it's a very dramatic subject, and it has a very, very surprising subject. We discussed laughter, which is the most surprising subject. We discussed how what looks like agony actually is what we understand to be laughter. This is a perfect example, right, of what we can extract out of what seems to be chaos. You have the following idea. This idea comes primarily, the one who put it together in this fashion, was the great Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Mir Rosh Yeshiva. He used to express it in the following way, which I'm about to share with you. He said, you have the following experience. What happens when someone falls? Let's tonight, for the next hour or so, let's look together at the experience of a fall. Let's look at what happens if somebody fails and falls. What happens and what can they do? Now, that's what we need. That's what we need. We've fallen already, so that's what we need. So there are some unique features of this human situation. Let's try and work it out together and see what we can do with it. Example to look at would be as follows. Try and look at a few examples. You'll see, we'll choose an example, one or two that come from the Sedra, Shavuos maybe, things that are topical now. Let's understand. That's the classical example is this. It says that when the Jews were in the desert, let's look at it from a Jewish point of view, Jewish people point of view, before we look at the individual level. Right, let's look at us as a people. What was the greatest fall we ever had, probably? It was the sin of the golden calf. Right? When we worshipped, when the Jewish people made an idol, and they worshipped gold, right, a physical finite object in the world instead of Hashem. There was no greater embarrassment than that. And it says in Chazal that it was like a... Chazal means our sages of blessed memory. I heard people last week asking what Chazal means. Our sages say that that event was like a bride who committed an indecent act of immorality under the chuppah. That means under the chuppah, she's getting married now to her chosen, and right by his side under the chuppah, that's what she does. That's what the Jewish people did. It was the moment of chuppah, that means we're getting married to Hashem, the Torah was being given, it was our bonding with Hashem, and at that moment, virtually, so we had in our hearts this infidelity, and we made this golden calf and worshipped it. A very difficult story to understand. That's what we're suffering from today. And because of that, Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain, he saw the people engaged in this thing, and so instead of giving them the tablets which he had, were amazingly transcendent, all the Mephoshim say that those tablets were on a level that had we received them, that no imperfection could have been possible after that. They were completely miraculous. I don't know if you know. Those tablets were written in a way that no human could understand. It says the letters were engraved right through them. They were blocks of stone. They were cubic in shape, by the way. They weren't like you see them drawn with flat things with round tops. They were cubic, and the letters were bored right through. But the letters were bored through in a miraculous way. The two letters in Hebrew that have inner sections, a samach and a mem, you know, they are completely closed letters. The middle section didn't drop out. It was suspended. You follow? Can you imagine engraving in stone a circle or a mem? Mem sofit, or a samach. The inner part of the letter didn't drop out. They were miraculous things. The whole Torah was written there, including the oral law. Had we received that, what happened was, he saw the sin that was being done, and he smashed them, and from then the world went into darkness, basically. The question we have to understand is this. How could they do such a thing? How could they do such a thing? There's the people who just spoken to Hashem. I mean, we wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have done that. If Hashem had spoken to me personally on one day, personally, Hashem had personally appeared to me, I had witnessed and experienced his revelation in so great a way that I had died. It says that. It says when the 3 million Jewish people stood at Sinai, as Hashem appeared to them and spoke to them, they all died. The first of the 10 commandments that Hashem spoke was so potent when they met that reality that the neshama that was in each human being couldn't bear to stay with the finite side of his being, and it flew back. The neshamas flew out to the source of being. The bodies, it says, were blasted back 12 miles. And the neshamas flew out towards Hashem. That's called dying. People died. Then Hashem revived them all. Actually, the Torah itself, the dibur that was being spoken, revived them. And the malachim, whatever that means, they helped them forward again to Sinai. They stood at Sinai a second time. Hashem spoke the second of the 10 commandments. And they died again. The same process. They were revived again. And when they were brought forward a third time, the Jews said, it's enough. They said to Moshe Rabbeinu, we can't take this anymore. It's a very difficult experience. We've seen enough to prove what we need to be proved. We now have direct evidence Right? We're very, very critical people. We need to experience the thing. So we've got that now. You hear the rest and tell it to us. And Hashem said that that was good that they did that. But the point is that they had that experience. It says the earth was filled with spice, incense. When Hashem spoke, it was an uncontrollable attachment. There was a spiritual air of incense that went out into the world. Amazing descriptions of what happened at that time. And they'd experienced that directly themselves. That means they'd become part of Hashem. Dying means that the Neshamas had gone to the source. They'd experienced that. People alive had experienced that. 40 days later, they make a piece of gold and they bow down to that. Well, how do you understand such a thing? And if that's what they did, I'm not proud to be descended from such people. If that's what they did, that's much worse than somebody who just makes an idol in the first place. Somebody who first has that experience and then he does that, the lowest thing there could be. Idolatry is the one thing, one of three things you have to give your life for. Give your life for that. Right? There are three things only in Judaism that you have to give your life for. Other things you can transgress. And it's the worst of them all. Because it's going to a false source. It's tracing things back to a source that's not correct. So it's having everything wrong. Sexual immorality is another one you have to die for. That's having a certain area wrong. Killing somebody is another one you have to die for. It's also having another aspect of reality wrong. But idolatry, that means having the whole of reality wrong. It means misperceiving what reality is. So that's the worst thing there could be. So they went from the most sublime level that any human had ever experienced, and a few days later they did that. But that takes understanding. What we can't unfortunately go into this evening is the understanding, the intrinsic mystical understanding of what they did. Because you just don't have time for that. Linda, sometime in the future, will go into that. Actually, suffice it to say for now that what they did was an act of great worship. Right. It was only called idolatry because at their level it was a mistake. What they thought they were doing was building an intermediary between them and Hashem. What had happened was that Moshe Rabbeinu, let's understand carefully, Moses had gone up the mountain and he had told them he would be back at a certain time. Let's stay together carefully now, we need the details. Moshe Rabbeinu had said to the people, I'll be back in 40 days, and they started calculating the 40 days. The Mephoshim say the following thing. They calculated the 40 days and they calculated wrongly. Because what he meant was 40 full days, and they counted 40 days exactly from that hour. Which means on the 40th day, according to their calculation, you follow? That means they started at the hour that he left, the 6th hour it says, and they calculated 40 days until the 6th hour of the 40th day and he didn't come back. Why didn't he come back? Because he didn't mean he'd come back in 40 days of 24 hour period. He meant he'd come back after 40 full days. Right? And it says that he didn't come back. The Torah even says, Ki boshesh Moshe, that Moshe Rabbeinu delayed. Boshesh means delayed. He delayed coming back. It means he wasn't back when he was expected. The people were at the foot of the mountain at Sinai, having had this intense revelation, they were waiting for Moshe Rabbeinu to come down. And so the Mephoshim say the word boshesh in Hebrew means to delay. But if you split it up carefully and read it well, it says ba shesh, to come at the 6th hour. That was the mistake. In other words, hidden in the word is indication of what they did wrong. They were expecting him back at a certain time and he was back only the next day. He was right. And he did exactly what he said he would, but they expected him at a certain time. What happened? So what happened, I'm only going to go, again, I'm warning you, we're only going into one side of it. If you wish to understand the other side, which is much, much deeper than this from a mystical point of view, we did discuss it once a few months ago on a Sunday evening, and I think the tape of that discussion is available, and we went into it in relatively great detail then. You referred to that discussion if you're interested in that subject. But what they tried to do was, since Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't down anymore, and they thought he was never coming back, they thought that he had died due to the power, the voltage of the spiritual experience that he'd been exposed to, he was never going to come back. They were left in the desert without anyone. So they tried to build at that moment an intermediary between them and Hashem, just like Moshe Rabbeinu had been. They tried to build, according to most of the Mephoshim, they tried to build the equivalent of what would later be the Mishkan, the sanctuary that they had in the desert, which they were commanded to build shortly after that, was an intermediary. It was a place where Hashem's presence focused, and they could have connection with Hashem there. So they tried to do that now to bring Hashem down. But there's no way to understand that they worshipped a piece of gold as a piece of gold. But it doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't make any sense for anybody with any intelligence in the first place. But for people who just met Hashem, to say that they worshipped a piece of gold is nonsense. It doesn't mean that. They tried to build an image on which Hashem's presence would rest, which is what Hashem's presence always does. Didn't his presence rest in the Mishkan just after that in the two golden kribim? That's exactly when I heard his voice speaking. Why was that necessary? We can't go into mystically now why Hashem's presence always focuses in a very small area. Why it's not manifest in the world in general. Why is it always from a very small and finite focus? You have to understand the depth of marriage to understand why that is. How a meeting and how intimacy occurs. We can't go into that now. That's the way the world works. The Mepharshim say that the stronger the love between us and Hashem, the smaller the place of meeting. You understand that? The smaller the object, the place where we meet. That's what it says. The Midrash says, when our love was strong. You hear how the Midrash puts it? When our love was strong, it means husband and wife, but it's talking about Hashem and us. It says, when our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. That's what it says. And when our love grew weak, a bed of 60 cubits was too small. And now that our love has grown even weaker, Hashamayim kisi, va'aretz hodom raglai. The heavens are my throne, and the earth's my footstool. Now we are far apart as heaven and earth. What does it mean? It means when husband and wife are together in the beginning, you can't cramp them up together enough. Not a problem. And people are in love, the more they cramp together, the narrower the space, the better. Doesn't make a problem. It can be squeezed in a place with nothing at their disposal except just cramped, but it's fine. But then after a few years of marriage, he moves into the east wing, she moves into the west wing, and they still cross paths too often. That's what happens. And after a while, the whole thing disintegrates. That's the history of the world. When our love was strong, we needed, we were able to meet in a very tight space. And that's why it says clearly that the Mishkan was such a tiny building. A tiny temporary building of skins with a tiny room where we met. When we went into Israel, and the whole relationship was much more distant than it was in the desert, so then we had to have a whole Beit HaMikdash, a temple, much, much, much bigger than the... And the second temple, I wonder if you know that the second temple was twice the size of the first. And after that, it exploded into the whole... The relationship now is separated as far as heaven and earth. That's what it means. That's the idea. So we had to have a focus where Hashem appeared. Why? Again, we can't go into now. That's a fact. So they desperately needed to build something that Hashem should manifest over there. We're not discussing the subject fully. I'm just trying to say the bare bones that we need for this evening's discussion. We have to come back to this. You have to research the subject for yourself to understand that they bowed down to a piece of gold. Got nothing Jewish about it, that idea. Completely non-Torah. It's irrelevant, that idea. They didn't do that. They tried to build something that would bring Hashem's presence to them. That's all they wanted. They had moved. They had followed Hashem into the desert. That's what it says. All they wanted was His presence with them. That's all they wanted. It says, Zachartu lachem chesed nuraich. I remember for you the kindliness. Chesed means the pure love of your youth. Ahavas klulosaich. The love of your bridal days. That's what Hashem says about us. I remember you when you were my young bride and you followed me into a desert. Lechteich acharai b'midbar. When you followed me into a desert. Eretz Lozrua, a land unsown. That's what it says. That's what Hashem says. He remembers about us. Not the way we're behaving now. He remembers about us the time when we moved out into a desert with nothing at all. No food every night, nothing at all. Trusting that the next morning He'd give us what to eat and drink. That's all we wanted, that's all we were. So that's all they wanted. When Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come back, they were lost. They felt lost. They'd been lost in the desert. Their leader wasn't coming back. How are they going to make the connection now? Hashem never spoke to them directly except for those two famous statements that he made. So they try to build something that would bring Hashem's presence back, and they chose wrongly. They chose wrong. They did wrong. It wasn't commanded, and therefore it was considered idolatry. Actually, they built. Why did they build a calf? If you want to know, why was it a calf? Because actually, the Merkava, which means the chariot on which Hashem rides, a mystical idea. It says the chariot has four corners, and the four corners of the chariot are the head of a human, which is why the Kerubim, those golden angels, whatever they mean, were human in form. Head of a lion, head of an eagle, and an ox. Calf. That's what the fourth one is. So they wanted to build an aspect of the Merkava. They wanted to build something in the world that represents what Hashem rides on. So He'd ride on it again. That's all they wanted, was a connection to Hashem. But at their level of greatness, of intensity, they should have had more emunah. That Hashem would not leave them, that Moshe Rabbeinu hadn't died, that He would come back. They should have had their emunah, and for them it's considered idolatry. Now let's understand the following point. That discussion, what we've just said, is aside, just enough to begin to go on. What we have to understand is that for them it was idolatry. That's what we have to understand now. I just can't bring myself to say that without explaining what we've just explained. Otherwise people further get the wrong idea that they were such a crude and lowly slave people that as soon as Hashem's back was turned, they bowed down to a piece of gold. That's the most anti-Semitic and violent, unspiritual, anti-spiritual attitude a person could have. And that's why we've said what we've said up to now. But now that we've said that, let's go further. For them it was considered idolatry. Because they were at such a level of greatness that making a graven image, making an image with all the frum motivations to bring Hashem down to them again, for them was considered idolatry. And that's why the Torah says so. The Torah doesn't mince its words. The Torah is talking about people at the level at which they are. For you, for them, that was considered idolatry. Had you been there, you would have thought it was the most incredible act of worship of Hashem. But at their level, people who merited, who built themselves through 49 stages, to the level that they could actually speak to Hashem face to face directly,
for people at that level, they were expected to have such an intensity of connection with Hashem that not for an instant were they expected to think about any intermediaries at all. And for them, when they did that, it was crude and crass idolatry, as you follow me, relative to their world. Now, so they did this act of idolatry. For them, it is idolatry, and it smashed the world. They were holding before that moment at the level of Adam before the sin. Adam Rishon Kodem Achet, that's where they were holding. And they did this thing and crashed the world into the misery that it's been in since then. And death and destruction and torture since then. Right? That's what they were responsible for. That's how bad the action was. And thousands died because of that, virtually on the spot. So Chaim asks the following question. How could people stoop to that? With all the explanation that we've just given. But nevertheless, it was idolatry. Nevertheless, for them, you have the understanding that one moment, virtually, they stood speaking to Hashem face to face, and then because of a little bit of an upset, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come back exactly when they calculated, they stooped to idolatry. Now, to understand the question, we have to understand the following point. You have to hear this very well, because what we're going to discuss now is the anatomy of how a person makes a mistake. We are now going to discuss how it happens that a person makes a mistake, and how a person lets that mistake finish him off and kill him. The art of being Jewish is to take great care not to make mistakes. That's the first thing. But everybody does. So there's an intrinsic, inalienable art of being Jewish, which is what you do when you've made a mistake. What you don't do is go to pieces and kill yourself and finish yourself, which is what most people do. As soon as people realize they made a mistake in life, an irreparable mistake, so what happens? That's the end. From then on in, it's just waiting till the thing's over completely. Depression, sense of failure, that's not what Judaism is. You'll see that every moment in Jewish history has been plagued by the most intense failure, and we're still what we are. And we're still going to bring the final revelation to the world. Right? The most intense agonies were gone through by all the forefathers, by every generation of Jews. Agony, torture, and the most intense sense of failure. The whole messianic experience is one of impending doom and failure. And it doesn't turn us off in the least. That's where we just get going. That's what a Jew has to know. And if we don't get that message clear in this generation, we're definitely going to amount to nothing. And we relish that experience. Right? Get finished off by that experience, we relish it. Understand? The reason and the anatomy, the way this thing happens is as follows. This is what happens. Says Reb Chaim, the way a person falls into failure, the way a person falls morally, or falls personality-wise, until they are not coping anymore, right, until they are a shattered version of what they should have been, the way it goes is as follows. The negative inclination, a person's own Yetzer Hara, their own lower self, right? The way he operates is he comes to you and he says the following thing. He says, just do this little thing. He doesn't say, fail. He doesn't try and smash you, because he knows you're too strong for that. Now, he just gets you to do something that's almost insignificant. It's just a touch beneath your level. That's all. That's all. Once you've done that, he comes to you after that and he says, well, look, this is where we are now, right? We're not where we were before, right? We're holding here now. Now, we've dropped the level, haven't we? We have to admit it. And he says, well, let's just do another little bit, that's all. Not much, hardly a difference, imperceptible. And you fail, and you fall to that level. And after that, you're holding at a new level. So then he tempts you with something, that's how it goes. And you fail, because each level is imperceptibly different from the one before. But nobody fails by going from the height to the depth. He can't do that to you. Imagine a person is holding very strong, right? The pinnacle of his, what he should be personality-wise. And has a crude urge to do something that's so base and disgusting that would have been the end of his personality. A person doesn't do that. He's disgusted by such a thing. We're going to fall into that. That's so much vested interest in staying where he is. Wouldn't succumb to that. Somebody's really made it, has worked on himself, whose pride is his self-control, who's really built himself into something personality-wise, who's withstood tests, and that's how he's got there. So when his own negativity comes to himself and says, give it all up and crash, he's not going to fall for that. So he can't operate that way. So he doesn't do that. If you think about it, if you think your Yetzer doesn't do this to you, in case you think that, think how it is when you argue with someone. How do you try and persuade somebody to do something? How do you try and persuade someone to do something that they shouldn't do, or that you want them to do, whether it's a child, or whether it's somebody, whatever it is? Do you walk up to them and just offer them the whole thing on a platter, open, naked, crude? Won't speak to you again. That's not the way it goes. No. First you tell them that they're right. First you hold at their level. You build them up to their level. Get them unawares. I don't mean you personally. And then, you offer them a suggestion that's innocuous. Almost no different. In fact, they might even not perceive that it's even any different, just that this has a little bit more potential for error than the previous, that's all. And when they're there, then you speak to them about the next stage. That's how it goes. And finally, you make an offer they can't refuse, because they can't refuse it now. They've sunk so low. Is that correct? That's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. That's what the Gemara says. That's the way. But he would never succeed if he comes to you and tries to take you from the pinnacle of success and collapse you entirely. Now, if that's correct, so how do we understand an experience like the one we just mentioned? The golden calf was an experience where, if there ever was an example of that, that was it. They were at the pinnacle of human experience. They were at the level of Adam before the sin, virtually. And they fell to the lowest level that humans says that the Jewish people, it says clearly that the Jewish people are higher than anybody else, much higher and much better than anybody else, much better than anybody else on earth. But when we fall much lower. That's what it says. Much worse than anybody else. Much worse. That's the price you pay for greatness. So they fell much worse than anybody else. They were higher than anybody else had ever been. No other nation had dreamed of such a thing. And they fell into Pasha the Prosta idolatry. How does that work? How does it work? What did the Yetzer do? How did he get them? You follow? How did he get them there? The whole concept that he works with, especially with the greatest of the great, is only an imperceptible difference at a time until finally before you realize that you've slipped. How did he get them? That's the question we have to understand. That's what we have to understand. So Khan explains the following thing, and this idea is critical. To hold on to this idea and to remember it, and you have to drill it into your consciousness, because the time when you need this idea is when you're failing and falling. It's easy to hold with all the high and noble ideals that we discuss between us on other occasions when things are going well. Then you remember that you're inspired and you feel noble and you manage. But when you're falling and failing and the world's crashing around you, that's when you have to remember this. Right? That's when you have to be an immaculate hero. Right? As you're being crushed, the last breath's being crushed out of you, that's when you have to remember this. But that's not easy. And the message is as follows. The reason that a person can't crash from the heights of achievement into the lowest of misery is because they're holding strong and they're stable where they are. And therefore, a person can fight off temptation, he can fight off, right? It's disgusting. But what happens if a person has a small fall? Small fall. What happens is, your equilibrium gets broken. And in the moment that you feel yourself falling, in the emotion of feeling that you're falling, your whole balance gets knocked away. And in that moment of instability, what happens is, you fall completely. In that moment, he can't come to you when you're strong. When you're holding strong and stable and everything's fine, and he tempts you with something very low, you brush him off without an effort. But when he feels you falling, when you made a mistake and you fall, or circumstances, or an isayon, an ordeal comes your way, and you fall, you fail. So you fail one step. Relative to your level, it might be very small. But you're shocked to find that you've fallen. You're shocked to find you are emotionally, you have a reaction where you feel you're not in balance anymore. You know you're not finished. You know you could recover. But you're fairly falling right now. In that moment of loss of balance, what happens is a panic sets in, and of course the Yetzer Hara, your own lower self, he's a lethal creature. He hits you when you're most vulnerable. He doesn't wait for when you're strong. He leaves you alone when you're strong. He only hits you when you're down. The Gemara calls him a manuvel. Impagabacham, manuvel there. Manuvel means a filthy carcass, a stinking, smelly carcass. That's what the Gemara calls him. He's the most unfair creature that there could be. He's you, of course. Not somebody else. It's you. He knows you. He knows exactly when you're weak, and he knows exactly where to hit you when it's going to hurt. And that's what he does. He doesn't attack you when you're strong. His job is to kill you. His job is... The reason he's there to kill you is so you can kill him and live. That's what you're on earth for. But he does his job properly. Alavai, you should do your job as well as he does his on you. So he waits until you fall. No such thing as fair play over there. The spiritual world is a lethal, locked-in life and death battle. No question about it. So he waits until you're a little bit disorientated, until something's gone wrong, and you're open to imbalance and to depression and to anxiety, and he magnifies and amplifies everything. He makes you feel like you're finished. That right? The whole world's suddenly gone black, and in that moment he tempts you and he sweeps your feet from under you and you fall into the lowest. So that happens. Let's try and understand this. And then we'll try and understand what to do about it. And that's a heroic story. While you're falling and while he hits you with everything that he has, then to be able to pull yourself back up at that moment. Trying to understand how. The Jewish people were standing at Sinai, and they were holding very strong. They were holding so close to Hashem that no people had ever held there. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come back. They waited for him. They'd waited 40 days. Right? They sat in the camp, they waited 40 days, at a pitch, a fever pitch of excitement. Moshe Rabbeinu was going to come down with the Torah, can you imagine? He's going to bring down the face to them. That's what the world had been created for. Can you imagine what you would have felt like waiting there? Part of a community of people that were fulfilling the purpose of the creation of the world. The Torah was about to arrive and you were about to be a recipient. And you've been promised that it would happen at a certain time. And you prepared yourself for that moment, and at that moment it doesn't come. So what happened? It says the Yetzer Hara, it says the Satan. It means the force that tempts a person and tries to kill him. That force in the world, understand what it means in personality terms, came to them and it showed them a funeral. It showed them a mystical representation in the spiritual dimension of a funeral. Moshe Rabbeinu is Leviah. Moshe Rabbeinu was laid out, he died, and he was being carried off to be buried. They saw that. They saw that, didn't imagine it, they saw it. They saw that. What was he trying to do? He was trying to make them feel hopeless. He was trying to make them feel that they reached too high. And now there was going to be no connection from here on in. And they failed. And from here, that's what he tried to do. And he made it. He succeeded. In that moment, they panicked. They suddenly realized that they were alone in a desert. They were alone in the desert. No place to turn. Where could they go? Back to Mitzrayim? Where were they going to go? Without any connection to the protection that there'd be no food to eat. The manna fell, as you know. The manna fell and none of it was remained for the next day. When the man was eaten one day, there was nothing left for the next day. Then they go to bed with a little bit in the fridge for the next day. They went to bed with nothing. Nothing at all. That means the little children, if there wouldn't be a miraculous manifestation of man the next day, we starved to death. They were far from any habitation. Deep in the heart of the Sinai Desert, you walk there for 3 hours, you know what it means. They were left alone in that situation. They didn't have the revelations, didn't have Torah yet, they didn't have Moshe Rabbeinu, their only connection with Hashem, that's everything that life was to them. They trained themselves, they were those who survived Egypt, 4/5 of the Jews in Egypt didn't, 80%, 4/5 of the Jews died during the plague of darkness, they couldn't hold at that level. These were the 20% who had the guts, they'd had what it took, they'd had their munah, they'd gone out only for love of Hashem, and now they'd lost that. So they panicked, and in desperation they scrambled to try and make something that would bring it back, and they failed. They failed. They made something that was considered for them idolatry. Why did they fall? Let's understand carefully. Why did they fall from the greatest pinnacle of human experience to the depth of human degradation in one instant and not stage after stage? Because the first stage was a fall. In that moment they panicked. In that moment of disequilibrium, the Yetzirah was able to have the big prize. So he went for the throat. That's what he does. And he managed to get them into the pit, which is what we're still suffering from. That's what he did. What we learn from that experience is this. That the way a person falls is gradually, stage by stage, and you can catch it. You have to remain sensitive. If you catch one stage and you build yourself up and strengthen yourself, you can catch it. But if you don't catch yourself, and you allow yourself to become a little disorientated, and you allow yourself to become a little depressed, or a little out of touch with reality, or whatever else it is that you may have a tendency to in such a situation when things aren't going right, and you project it into the future, and you make it much worse than it is, and you start to expand it and amplify it and whatever else we usually do in such situations, so then what could happen next is, not just that you'll go one stage down, oh no. What could happen next is that completely unnecessarily, you could kill yourself. You could finish yourself. That's what could happen. Think about yourself, think about people you know, think about situations that you may have seen that were far from the end, that people collapsed in. This is the mechanism, this is what happens. They should have held strong. Aaron was still around. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't there. Aaron Cohen was around. Why didn't they go to Aaron and ask him, where's Moshe? And have it explained to them. Why didn't they ask him? Why didn't they turn to Hashem? Why didn't they? Plenty they could have done. You have to panic right now. You can't wait till tomorrow. What's the rush? They went to Aaron. Aaron said, let's wait till tomorrow. He knew what was going on. He said, let's wait till tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll do what's necessary. We'll have a special Yom Tov to celebrate this whole thing. They couldn't wait till tomorrow. The Yetzirah was so powerful that it got them to make this thing, and the Chazal say that the only reason that they made a golden calf was to permit themselves sexual immorality. Do you know that? It says the Jewish people never ever worshipped idolatry except as a method of permitting themselves forbidden relationships in public. That's what it says. And as soon as they did the golden calf, that was the permission, and they got engaged in the most despicable and disgusting of human behavior that you can imagine. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu saw when he came down. When he came down the mountain, he heard the sound. And Yeshua said to him, I hear a sound of war. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, that's not the sound of war. That's much worse. And he was right. And that was the end. They panicked. Felt lost and alone. And they panicked. And that's what happens. Everybody feels lost and alone.
Last week, Sedrit says the following story. There was a man. Listen to this. Let me give you a few examples. Examples from Chumash, it's easier to relate to. When you go home and make your own. There was a man who came to pitch his tent, it says. You know, in Sefer Vayikra that we're reading now, there are only two events in the whole book that are stories. Do you know that? The whole book is laws of Kohanim and sacrifices, Korbanos, Beis HaMikdash, the whole book, the whole Sefer. There are only two stories in it that are events that happened, and this is one of them. There was a man, Ben Isha Yisraelis, the son of a Jewish woman, the son of a Jewish woman, came to pitch his tent in the camp of Dan, in the Shevet, the tribe of Dan, and it says, Yotzo, he went out, and he cursed Kiviyochel, the creator of the world. That says, Amon, but Gideth means blasphemy. It means what the Gemara calls blessing Hashem. It doesn't mean blessing Hashem. It means, God forbid, the opposite. Are you with me? But we can't bring ourselves to say that. But are you with me? So we say blessing Hashem, but Chas V'Shalom means the opposite. He went out, and that's what he did. One second. Here's a man in the Jewish people who witnessed the revelation at Sinai, is constantly witnessing Hashem's presence like no other generation ever has. Every morning he wakes up and sees a miracle. Not many miracles. He's surrounded by clouds on all six sides, divine presence. He's led at night by a pillar of fire and the day by a special pillar of cloud. I mean, what more do you need? What more do you need to relate to Hashem closely? He gets up and he curses the creator of the world? Well, what happened to him? You realize that I don't have to point out to you, we're dealing with somebody who went from the greatest of human experiences to the most abysmally low of human experiences. And he was killed. He was killed for that. They asked Hashem what to do, and he said such a person has to be killed, and he was executed. That's what happened. He lost his world in a moment. He lost the next world also. He didn't just get killed. He lost his share in this world and the next. Returns in Chumash Yotso. He went out. What do you mean he went out in the camp? What do you mean he went out? What do you mean he went out? So the Chazal have two opinions. See in Rashi. Rashi says, Me'oi lomo Yotso. He went out of his world. That's what it means. He really went out. Chumash doesn't say anything insignificant. We don't care if he went out of this area or that area. He went out of his world. He lost the world. He lost everything, spiritually as well as physically. And the other opinion is, Yotso Mibayis Dino Shel Moshe. He went out of the courtroom of Moses. This is what happened. Listen to the story. It's an amazing story. Listen. Understand a new depth in what we said up to now. This man was the son of an Israelite woman. That's a strange description, isn't it? Weren't they all? The Jewish people in the desert? Ben Isha Yisraelis, he was the man of a Jewish woman. You know why it says that? Because his father wasn't Jewish, so it says. His mother was, but his father wasn't. Who was his father? His father was an Egyptian. How did it happen? His father was an Egyptian who had a relationship with a Jewish woman. Her name was Shlomis Bas Dibri. That was her name. And he was conceived and he was born. He was Jewish. He was the son of an Israelite woman. But his father wasn't Jewish. What was the problem? By the way, you should know that it says in Chazal that in 210 years of slavery, listen to this, the Jewish people in 200 have to know who we are. And this doesn't make you weep, I don't know what will. In 210 years of slavery, in the most perverted nation on earth, so perverted that when the firstborn died, nobody who was expected to die died. Only the unexpected died because nobody knew who was the firstborn. In every home, what the father thought was the firstborn of his wife wasn't. And what she thought was his firstborn wasn't at all. All kinds of people died that weren't expected to die. The most immoral and perverse nation on earth. It's called in Hebrew Ervas Haaretz. It means the nakedness of the world. It means worse than that, but I can't bring myself to say it in English. That's who they were, the Egyptians. In a place like that, who had total power over the Jewish people, it says that in all the years of Egypt's power, not just the 210 years that we were there, but in all the years of Egypt's dominion as a world culture, no slave ever escaped. You hear that? Not once did a slave ever escape. That absolute and total power. In all that time, it says in Chazal, there was one incident of immorality, and the Torah tells you. That was this. A Jewish woman with a non-Jewish man, can you imagine that? That's called withstanding slavery. Being able to stand up to the labor is nothing. To stand up to that sort of torture, to that sort of pressure, and there wasn't one single event of immorality at all, and that event was almost unavoidable. Because the Gemara says that he impersonated her husband. She didn't know who he was. He impersonated her husband, and she was caught in that situation before she realized. That's how it happened. So even that situation she had no control over. And despite that, the Torah tells you about it to tell you that achas hoyso prisam akosu. It was one example only, and the Torah pointed out
Why did it happen, by the way? Because the name was Shlomi Spaz Dibri. Shlomi Spaz Dibri means, Shlomi means Shalom. She used to say Shalom to everybody
whom she shouldn't have. You hear what I'm what's going on here? If a woman guards her modesty, she won't get into trouble. But she made it her business to initiate discussion and greet everybody, including people she shouldn't have. She spoke too much. She had too high a profile. She was noticed. And that's what happened. Be that as it may. So now what happened? That's the background. So this man is born. And he's a Jew, just like any other Jew. There's no blemish. You know that. There's no blemish on a Jew. Not a mamzer. There's no blemish on a Jew who's born from a Jewish mother. Perfectly normal Jew, just like anybody else. He goes out in the camp. He tries to pitch his tent in the camp of Dan. And something goes wrong. And because that thing goes wrong, he goes out and he does the worst thing that a Jew can bring himself to. I don't think even in this low generation any Jew could do that. I don't think any Jew could bring himself to do that. To curse in that way? I doubt it, even in this lowly generation. He did that. What happened? This is what happened. Listen carefully. He tried to pitch his tent. And as he tried to pitch his tent, another man came up to him and said, "You can't pitch your tent here." So he said, "But why not?" He said, "Because you're not from the tribe of Dan." He said, "Of course I'm from the tribe of Dan." So the man said, "Oh no, you're not. The tribe goes by the father. If you belong to the tribe of Dan, you must be born from a man. Jewish religion, being Jewish, goes after your mother. But which of the 12 tribes you belong to goes after the father? So what do you mean you want to pitch your tent here? You must be in the right place. There's a very important halakha that every Jew had to have his special place. You don't belong here." The man had no place to go. Suddenly he doesn't belong to any shaykh. So he went to Moshe Rabbeinu's Beis Din and he was judged against. He went out and he cursed. That's what he did. And he lost his world. What happened? You hear what happened? He was on a level of the Jewish people who had reached the level of Adam before the sin. He had seen Hashem directly. Right? He was at Sinai. He himself. We know he was at Sinai because this conception had happened in Egypt, it says. If I'm not mistaken. He experienced Hashem himself directly. Right? And he fell to death. Because that man at that level suddenly found he was a man without a place. His whole emotional being, his whole identity was shattered. His whole sense of identity was shattered. They took away the place from under his feet. No ground to stand on anymore. So in that moment of crisis of identity, you hear? Same story. It was a moment of personality crisis. He didn't know who he was. And what happened? He fell completely. His Yad Tahara was very powerful. He was a man who was powerful enough to meet Hashem face to face. He was powerful enough a man to stand up to that revelation. That's how it works. The more power you have in one direction, the worse it will burn you and fry you when that power is turned against you. Definitely. That's what happened. He shouldn't have done that. He should have gone to Moshe and said, "What do? I'm no fault of my own. I'm here in the world, a kosher Jew like you. Give me a place to be." He didn't do that. He allowed that disequilibrium, the sudden realization that he wasn't who he thought he was, to kill him. Let me give you a third example. And then we'll try and see what a person can do about it. Her example is very much connected with Shavuos. That example was from last week's Sedra. This example is very much connected with Shavuos. It says that Ruth, the great woman whose story we read on Shavuos, who became the great grandmother of King David, no less than that. She came from Moab, from the Moabite people, a despicable people, people who had been born from an incestuous relationship between their father and between Lot and his daughter, right? So low that they were never allowed to convert into the Jewish people. Never. Right? That's how bad they were. Moab, they were so, even the name of the people means "from my father." That means they're so shameless. They were even named after the incestuous relationship that they had come from. She started there, and she ended up the great-grandmother of King David. That's some rise to greatness. She come from being, right, at the pinnacle, at the head of the most low nation on earth, one of the lowest, and she rose from there to become the great-grandmother of the Mashiach, of the messianic revelation in the world. What's the story? The story is this. I'm not going to go through the whole story of Ruth. You should prepare it definitely before Shavuot. To make sure it's meaningful, you have to know the story. You have to know the details, and you have to read them before Shavuot. You should get it in English. You should read Mamla Eid on it. Definitely, you must know the story. But very briefly, what happened was, she was a princess in Moab. She was from the leading house of Moab. A princess. She married a Jewish man. So happened that a man, a leader of the Jewish people, fled in time of drought, which he shouldn't have done. He fled to Moab with two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They married two girls, two Moabite girls. The whole discussion about when they converted, they did convert to Judaism, but they married these girls. And they died. For certain reasons, both of them died. Naomi, her mother-in-law, you remember the story, I'm sure most people. Naomi, her mother-in-law, who had been married, right, to the man who had fled with his sons, they were all left widows, and so they started making their way back to Israel. Where else were they going to go? They started making their way back to Israel. Naomi was a Jewish woman. She was coming back there to Israel. Her two daughters-in-law, Ruth, and Orpah, her sister, two princesses from Moab, who had been married to two brothers, leaders of the Jewish people, they started coming with her towards the Jewish people. Doesn't only mean they walked towards Israel, it means they came towards converting to becoming part of that great nation, the Jewish people. What happened? You know the story, famous story, even in the world secular literature, it's well known. As they came close to the border, right, as they came close to the border, Naomi tried to dissuade them, which is the law. One is obliged to dissuade a convert. We don't need converts, we don't want them, it's not good for us and not good for them. It's very bad for us converts, because it shows us up when people convert to Judaism. That's what it says. It shows what a person can do. So you're supposed to dissuade them. So she tried to turn them back. She said, what do you need it for? The Jewish people, there's so many mitzvahs, how difficult, all the mitzvahs. She even went through the fact that at the end of their life, they'd have to be buried in a different place. If you do certain sins, you have to be buried in it. There's so much risk involved. What do you need it for? Go back to your people. You had a wonderful life. You're princesses. You'll have everything. What's the problem? She doesn't demand more of you than that. She wants you to be the most you can be in your situation. What do you need it for? And they said, no, we'll come with you. And she dissuaded them again three times. Finally, at the critical moment, what happened was, it says, Orpah Noshka, Orpah kissed her, Verus Davkaba, and Ruth clung to her. Orpah kissed her and went back to her people, and Ruth clung to her mother-in-law and came back to the Jewish people. What happened? What was the result? The result was as follows. Listen carefully. Ruth crossed the border. She came into the Jewish people. She became the wife of Boaz that night, or shortly after that. Out of that relationship, they had a child, right, whose child was Yishai, whose child was David, King David, and she was still alive, by the way, when Solomon was born. He used to stand up in honor for her. You imagine that? Great-great-grandmother. Her son was the father of Yishai, was the father of David, who was the father of Shlomo. She was still alive. That was her merit in the world. She was still alive when he was born, and when he ruled Israel for 40 years, she used to stand up for her. She had a place of honor next to him. That's who she became. Right? And when the Mashiach is born and comes into the world, it'll be because there was a woman called Ruth who bore him. What happened to Orpah? What happened to her sister? What happened to her? That's the side we don't know. What happened to Orpah? You know what Orpah means? Oref means the back of the neck. She turned her back on what she could have been. That's what Oref means. Ruth came in. What does Ruth mean? Do you know what the word means, Rus? Do you know what the word means? And if we count up the letters, it adds up to 606. Ruth, Reish, Vav, Tav, comes to 606. Why? Because she took on 606 mitzvahs. She had seven already, right? She had seven as a non-Jew. Seven mitzvahs that a non-Jew has. So her greatness was she took on 606 mitzvahs to become a Jew. That's what she became. And Orpah turned the back of her neck on her mother and went back to her people. What happened? It says that night, I don't know if I can bring myself to tell you the details, but it says that night she encountered a body of military men, some soldiers, and she had a relationship with 100 men and one dog. It says in Midrash. That's what happened. So the question is this. Orpah was one of the greatest people alive. It says clearly in Chazal she was on the same level as Ruth. They were two sisters, identical. They were able to marry two brothers. They both were coming towards the same great fulfillment in the world. Huh? That's her potential. She fell from being a woman who was side by side with Ruth. Right? That level of idealism, who took prime place in the history of the world, and she fell to that. By now, I'm sure you can put it together for yourself, but I'll do it for you. What happened was this. As they walked towards Israel, it was the greatest moment of her life. Right? She was coming now, not just to an event in her life, as in the previous cases that we've discussed, but she was coming to the moment of her life. She was about to face the moment that would be critical. Right? She was about to be offered. Hashem was presenting to her that opportunity, which it says in Chazal often, only knocks once. When the opportunity knocked, she failed. She was given the chance. She had a motivation. She knew what it meant. She saw she was with Ruth, who was prepared to give everything for that. It says that Ruth, from being a princess in Moab, what did she give up to become a mother in the Jewish people? What did she give up? Where she was living in Moab, she was a wealthy, at the pinnacle of her people. She had everything at her feet. Right? But when it says she came to Israel, what was her idealism? It says they walked on the road to Beit Lechem. So the Mefoshim, I think Rashi on the spot says, what do you mean she walked on the road? Of course it was on the road. Does the Megillah have to tell us extra words that they walked on the road? That means really on the road. She had no shoes. That's what it means. She gave up even. She had no shoes. She was that poverty stricken. When she came to Israel, she had to collect the sheaves of corn, the ears of corn that the reapers left in the fields. There's a mitzvah that you don't pick up the forgotten ears of corn so that those who have nothing to eat can pick up the ears of corn. So she was reduced to that from being a princess in Moab. She had to go around as a beggar and pick up forgotten ears of corn to live on and to feed her mother-in-law with. But she chose it. She chose it. She chose the spiritual world over the physical world. She chose the elevated world of spirituality where the body is nothing and where there's only suffering, with the Jewish people who are downtrodden and beaten. She chose that over a life of luxury and physicality. That's what she did. And as she came to that decision, she was walking side by side with Orpah. And Orpah realized exactly what the decision was. And Orpah was walking with Ruth, and she saw what was happening. And at the moment of crisis, when that ordeal faced her, when she was able to go on with her sister and become one of the greatest people who ever lived in the history of the world, she just couldn't take it. She turned back. She turned back. And as she was walking back on the road to Moab, she suddenly realized what she'd done. And that moment of realization was so powerful, right, that instead of just being a girl who hadn't made it to the pinnacle of history of the world, and no more than that, she felt a woman who was able to fall into the animal world in the worst possible way. Why? Same reason as we discussed before. One is faith-blind experience in love, where you know that this experience could have made you, this is what you were here for. It happens to people. You know that this is what you were here for. Some things only happen once in life, some opportunities. This is your challenge, and you realize you walked away from it, you just didn't have what it took. That's enough to kill you. And it killed her. What was the result of it, by the way? If you just want to know how far these things go, I'm not going to go into this in detail, I don't want to keep you too late. What was the result of this? You know what it says in Tanakh? Unbelievable thing. What was the result? The result was the following thing. What happened to Ruth? What happened to Ruth? She became the great-grandmother of King David. King David, when he was a young boy, we discussed this a few weeks ago under the heading of the Mashiach, you remember that when he was a young boy, he had to go and fight a man called Goliath. He had to go and fight him. The most impossible battle imaginable. He was a tank of a man. He was a giant. He was invincible. The Jewish army, it had merit, physical power that's unbelievable, but it had spiritual power that's unbelievable. Yishai was alive, the father of David. He was one of the four people who never ever sinned, ever, it says. There were only four people in the world who never sinned, and he was one of them. So that incredible power, an incredible merit. Right? There was never a generation as great as that in Jewish history, virtually. Certainly not after it. And they couldn't stand up to this one man? You follow? He was so powerful, this man, that he mocked them, he taunted them. He used to come out in front of the Jewish army, a Philistine. He used to come out in front of the Jewish army and say to them, who's going to fight me? Come and fight me. And the great heroes of the Jewish people couldn't take him on. Until what happened? A little boy, King David, a boy, a shepherd boy, whom nobody thought anything of. He walked up and he said, I'll fight him. So they scorned him and they heaped derision on him, and his brother was angry with him. And finally he said, well, look, I had a bit of a sign. I killed a lion and I killed a bear that came to tear my flock apart, and I felt Hashem was helping me. So I'm sure Hashem will help me now. And after all, I've got my little slingshot. I've got a stone over here. What more do you need when Hashem's on your side? So they were great spiritual people, and they thought maybe he deserves a trial. So they tried to put Saul's armor on. He couldn't stand up in the armor. Never mind fight this man. They couldn't lift up the sword. So he said, well, look, I'll do without it. I'll go out there with my... And he went out and he killed. You know what Chazal say? Where did this man come from? Where did a man of such power come from? He must have come from a very powerful beginning. Very powerful background. This man, Goliath, this giant, who had the power of a giant spiritually, enormous evil power. Where did he come from? You know where he came from? His great-great-grandmother was Orpah. That's where he came from. That's why he met, just like Ruth and Orpah had that experience together. So their great-great-grandsons met each other in that way. But he in the black side, because she had generated that kind of blackness. And if you think about it further, you'll see that that's why he was called a dog. I don't want to go into that anymore. That's why it's referred to. Be that as it were. Now let's understand, what are we supposed to do about this? That's the danger, okay? That's the danger. That's what can happen to a person. That's what does happen to people. That's what happens to people all around you all the time. That's the natural tendency. That's what happens. That's what the Yetzer is waiting for. That's what he throws himself into. That's how he tries to kill you. That's exactly what he does. He waits patiently till you make a mistake, and then he tries to kill you. What are you supposed to do? So let us end with this idea. Let's take one or two examples of people who've been through that and who coped, who didn't fail. We've just discussed some examples of people who went through such experiences, and they didn't make it. They allowed that shaking of the equilibrium to kill them, right, to finish them off. Let's understand one or two examples from Tanakh of people who experienced that and had the greatness to live correctly in such torment. Right? People who fell from the pinnacle of greatness to the depth of despair, and during the fall, while they were tumbling, were able to do what's needed, to understand, able to do what's needed while you're tumbling in order to hold on and to survive and to win and to get back to where you were before, if not better, if not greater. And that's what it's for. That's what that ordeal is for. Let's understand. Just take two examples and understand them. One was King Shlomo himself, Solomon. I wish we had time to go into the details. I'll give you briefly the overview of what happened. You know what the Gemara says about him? The unknown side. Right? Unless you know anything about Torah Shabbat there, you won't know this. It's between the lines in Tanakh, but this is what the Gemara says about him. King Solomon. King Shlomo was the greatest man alive. He was the wisest man who ever lived. He was the wisest man who ever lived. Right? When he was 12, you know that thing with the baby that he said they should cut in half? You remember the famous story of King Solomon? He was 12. It was the first thing he did as king. It wasn't even bar mitzvah yet. That's how he impressed the Jewish people. That's how he began his rule. He was the wisest man. There wasn't anything in heaven or earth that he didn't know. Huh? That's who he was. It says that the Mashiach, will be a little less in prophecy than Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, and greater in wisdom than Shlomo. But that's the only man. The Mashiach will be greater in wisdom than Shlomo, but that's the only man ever. Apart from him, he was the wisest man. Chacham Mikol Olam, the wisest man who ever lived. And he ruled Israel. And not only that, but he ruled so successfully, he was privileged to rule at a time when there was only peace. He ruled for 40 years of peace. There was no war. David had a very difficult time. David had everything go wrong. But Shlomo, the word means perfection. Shlomo, Shalom, means peace and perfection. Right? It also means Hamoshel, which is the one who gave great analogies for Torah. I mean, that's who he was. Absolute perfection in every sense, and peace and recognition of his perfection and his greatness. That's who he was. We know what the Gemara says about him? Listen to this. Gemara says, one day, because of his great knowledge, listen carefully, many, many, many things to be learned from the story. Unfortunately, we have to go into this another time to learn the lessons of this story, because it's one of the most fascinating aspects of Gemara. Openly mystical, fantastic, literally fantastic. But we'll just extract from it the elements that we need for now. This is what happened. One day, through the greatness of his intellect and his wisdom, he perceived where the source of negativity was on earth. I'm not going to go into this in detail. Some of it we're not allowed to. But there is a force on earth called Shalim. I don't want to even say the word too much. Do you know what I'm referring to? These are creatures that are midway between the physical and the spiritual worlds. Okay? These are creatures. It's doubtful whether we see them today. They're very, very negative. Terribly evil forces. Today, probably, we are so low, we don't even come up to the world and see them. Okay? Today. So in case you think you've seen any of them, today we probably fall even below the level of that kind of impurity. They are formed from, again, it's very hard to go into this, they're formed from the experience that a man has without a woman. I can't go into detail. They are creatures of, they're formed from the imagination and dreams. They were formed in the world from Adam, the time that he spent without his wife, 130 years, that they were separated. You have to ask me privately if you happen to be male some other time. I can't tell you the details. So ask your husband, I don't know. Send him to Yeshiva and get him to tell you. The point is that they formed from a certain kind of male force in the world that doesn't have a woman to take up that force and give it a body. And therefore they have only the energy input side, they don't have the body. The only body they have is the little bit of body that a male can give to his own formative energy. That's all. Which means that they do reproduce, it says. They do certain physical things in the world, but other things they don't do physically. If you know how, you can see their footprints, it says in the Gemara. If you know how to prepare a certain place, you can actually see their footprints. I very strongly recommend that you don't try and do that. But they have some physical manifestation in the world. Something to do with the feet also, which is a whole story, why the feet and why the feet manifest in footprints, maybe for another time after midnight. The point is, for now, there are these things called shadings. These things cause tremendous negativity in the world. It says they cause the legs of Talmidei Chachamim to become weak, again the knees. They cause your clothes to wear out. They cause friction. These are the things called shading. Shading, by the way, mean creatures of shade. A shade is it's a word of imagination. You know, the manna was called Lashad Hashem, the same word. You know why? Because you could taste in the manna whatever you wanted, according to the imagination. It also means breasts. Because it says the child tastes in the milk whatever he wants to taste. You hear that? So these creatures are creatures of them. They're very real. Don't think they're imaginary. They're very real. But they're creatures of the imagination. Anyway, they are tremendously evil forces. Shlomo perceived how to get control of the king of the Shadim. The king of the Shadim was a being called Ashmedai. Ashmedai ruled. He ruled the evil world. Shlomo knew that if he could capture him, he would control evil. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what a prize that would be? All the great men in Jewish history made their mistakes, by the way. Failed in the battle against the source of evil. They were great enough to battle the source of evil. That's why they did it. In order to kill evil completely and bring about the messianic revelation. And who was greater and more able to do it than Shlomo? So he understood it was his responsibility. But you're playing with fire. You're playing with fire. To go into the den, into the zone. By the way, all Western fairy stories, fighting dragons and going into the cave of evil and saving the princess, they come from deep, deep Torah spiritual sources. I don't know if you know that. Deep Torah sources that are the basis, not just nonsense. To go into the zone of evil and capture it and kill it, that's the great prize. That brings the world to its perfection. But the mystics call taking the sparks out of the impure dimension and bringing them home. So he tried to do that. He tried to capture him. He was the king of Israel, king of the world. He tried to capture the king of the Shadim. And he did. It says he sent out people with a certain chain, a collar, a certain kind of a chain with Hashem's name on. I'm not going to go into detail. You can look it up in the Gemara. It's openly discussed in the Gemara. And they managed to capture him by putting this chain around him. I have to understand what this means, please. It's not to be understood physically. If you understand this at all physically, you're making a terrible mistake. It's 100% literal. It couldn't be more literal if only we knew how literal it is. But not physically, like a fairy story. Nevertheless, and the Gemara's got the most wonderful stories as they brought Ashmedai back to Shlomo. It says amazing things. He started laughing. While they were bringing him back in chains, he was powerless. And they said, what are you laughing at? And he said, look at that man. There was a man who was looking into the distance for treasure. And Ashmedai said, look under his feet. And under the man's feet, very, very deep stories. But we haven't got time for that now. Anyway, they brought him back to King Shlomo. And King Shlomo kept him in chains. Which means, you understand what that means? He kept the dimension of imagination in chains. It means there was only reality in the world. It was only perfection, only reality. Imagine the bliss of that existence. It was almost a messianic existence. One day, Shlomo called him in. And he said to him, he wanted wisdom. Tell me how you people operate. How do you function? He wanted to understand. So Ashmedai said, take this thing off and I'll show you. So Shlomo took it off. And it says he swallowed him. Ashmedai swallowed him. Swallowed him. According to one opinion, he threw him 400 parses. 400 parses means 400, let's say, kilometers of flak. What it means, it's actually the length and breadth of Eretz Yisrael. It means he threw him out of the Kedusha. You follow what's being said here. Literally, it means he threw him out of Israel. But in spiritual terms, it means he threw him out of the Kedusha. He projected him into a dimension of impurity. And what did he do? You know what he did? He sat on the throne and ruled. Because he looked exactly like Shlomo. Of course he did. He was the king of evil. And he's a creature of the imagination. So he looks exactly like what you see in the mirror. Of course he did. He looked exactly like Shlomo. Nobody could tell the difference. And he ruled. Do you hear what's happening? This is what we all face, by the way. This is what we all face. You have to understand this very deeply. He ruled. He sat on the throne. And what did Shlomo do? What did he do? He was left penniless and poverty stricken as a beggar in the streets, going around trying to tell people who he was. And people said, yes, we've met people like you. You're the king of Israel. Is that so? You, King Shlomo, the king of Israel? Is that so? While they saw the king ruling on the throne, and this beggar, this mendicant, was going around the streets with nothing but a cloak. It says all he had left, according to one opinion, all he had left was a sort of a cloak, a coat. And according to another opinion, he had a stick, his staff. That's all he had. And that's all he had, no other possessions. So he walked around trying to tell people who he was. And here, you follow, could you imagine the agony of that situation? The king of Israel who'd made a fatal mistake. And he'd been cast from grace, from favor. And he was walking the streets trying to get back to who he was and trying to get the Jewish people to understand. And can you imagine the agony of knowing who's ruling the world? The greatest force of evil is ruling the world. And he looks exactly like you. And you don't, isn't that what we all face? That you can't express what it is you're supposed to be? No one's not bringing stories that just happened to one person. That's what everybody goes through. If only you'd be given the opportunity. Isn't that right? You really deserve to be there. And you are. It says, call B'nai Yisrael. Call Yisrael B'nai Malachim. Every Jew is a prince or princess. That's where you should be. You just can't get there. You're just bound by circumstance. That's all. You just don't have what it takes, the wherewithal. If only the right people would surround you. If only they wouldn't batter you emotionally and psychologically. If only you weren't ill. If only this, if only that. You never express yourself. You go through, well, you express yourself. So you make a living from day to day. If you're lucky. And those who make a living well got worse problems because they're too busy to ever think about who they are. So they certainly don't express themselves. Those who are struggling to make ends meet never express themselves. They're worried about eating. And those who are making a living well and are wealthy are much too busy. They're much too busy to buoyed up by a false image, but they never express it. That's what happened. So what happened? The rest of the story, I'm just going to focus on what we need to know. But I'll just for completeness, I'll tell you what happened. How long did he rule? How long did he rule, this Ashmedai? According to one opinion in the Gemara, for 40 years. And according to Rav and Shmuel, the Machlokes in the Gemara, one opinion says for 40 years, and one says forever. Shlomo never got back. I think, I hope, we pass like the one that says for 40 years, and Shlomo got back. We hold that one. He got back to his greatness. Melech v'hedyot v'melech, and the other one says Melech v'hedyot. He was a king and then a commoner. The other opinion says he was a king, a commoner, and a king again. That's the opinion that we'll follow that opinion for now. But you hear the risk? You hear what's going on here? How did they discover in the end who Ashmedai was, and how did they correct the situation? How did the Jewish people resurrect? How did they perceive the truth in this terrible, terrible situation? The Sanhedrin, who were responsible for running the Jewish people, got a feeling that something wasn't right. They got a feeling that this man on the throne wasn't who he used to be. So they wanted to find out about him, but the only way you can find out about a shade, there's no way you can find out about a shade, it looks exactly like the real thing. Of course it does. He's the black side of reality. He knows what he's doing. He looks exactly like he's supposed to look. How do you find out what's at the core of a person? How do you find out what's at the core of a man? There's only one way to find out what's the deepest, innermost core of what a man is. Ask his wife. She knows. After the first few hours of marriage, it says, she knows exactly. You can't fool her. A man can fool the rest of the world and usually tries to, but his wife, he can't fool at all. Shlomo had a number of wives. So they called in the wives. They called in the wives and said, this man, you know him intimately. Is he normal? So the woman said, no, he's not normal. They said, what do you mean? So the women said two things. He calls Bathsheba. You know what that means? He calls, you know, the king, the women used to stay in a certain place. For conjugal marital rights, he used to invite whichever wife was appropriate, let's say. Right? He used to call that woman. He was calling Bathsheba. Bathsheba was his mother. You hear that? And not only that, they said, but he calls us when we're nida. When we are menstrually, when we're menstruating, he calls us in for conjugal. So then they knew what was going on. Why was he doing that? I'm not going to go into it now, but that's where the evil forces draw their energy from. Isn't that right? That's exactly where they draw their energy from those impure forces. When a woman is in the phase where life cannot be brought to the world, where life is being lost from the world, her lifeblood is being lost from the world, from the very place of the body that should conceive life, that's the ultimate force of negativity. That's why we don't go near our wives. Right? We don't even have the slightest contact of affection between a husband and wife when she's in that situation. Because that's tremendously black energy. It's got nothing to do with being unclean. Well, that's another anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic perversion. It's got nothing to do with cleanliness. It's a tremendously potent spiritual force. It's so bad that all death forces in the world are derived from there. That's where they want to suckle. That's what they want to drink from. They want to suckle from that force of impurity. So of course he needed that. Of course he needed a woman like that. Of course he couldn't live if it wasn't for that. That's what he was doing. And then they knew. Anyway, that's not for tonight. That's another story, some other time. But the question we want to know is this. What did King Solomon do? How did he get back there? Do you agree that was a fall? That was a fall? He fell from being the greatest man on earth, the man who was responsible for the future of the world. Out of him was going to come the Mashiach. And he ruled Israel and ruled the world. And he'd fallen to the pit, and he'd fallen into an impossible situation. He didn't just fall. He fell into an impossible situation. The examples we gave before were people who fell slightly and allowed themselves to think that it was worse than it really was. Orpah could have turned back. Orpah could have turned back. She could have run after Naomi and said, I'm here. What have I done? But she didn't. She fell. And the Jewish people could have hung on and spoken to Aaron. And the man who cursed that I he could have gone and asked Moshe. It wasn't so bad. And they fell. But Shlomo, what was he supposed to do? He fell to the bottom, the pit, the deepest pit on earth, and nobody would believe him. Well, that's a real fall. How did he get back to who he was before? You know what it says? Unbelievable thing. An unbelievable thing. It says that, listen carefully to the sensitivity, the way Chazal explained it. All he was left with in the world was, the Gemara argues, one says a cloak and one says a stick. That's all. Why did they bother to tell us that? Say Chazal the following amazing insight. He remained a king over his cloak, or according to the other opinion, he remained a king over his staff. You hear that? Listen to this. He was king of the world. Okay, 100% literally king of the world. He fell into a situation where he had nothing left but a stick. You know what he did? He remained a king over that. What you have left, don't give up that. Because everything else has been lost, you have to give up everything else that you remain with. So you're not with a matchstick. You're going to throw that away too? No, you remain with your matchstick, with dignity, and you rule it. Can you imagine such greatness? Can you imagine that? Plummeting from the pinnacle of responsibility in the world and greatness, he plunged into the deepest abyss on earth, so he's left with almost, so you know what he did? He said, well, I've got almost nothing. So I'll rule that. And he maintained his dignity and his royalty and his kingship and everything that he was over what was left to him. And that brought him back to what he was before. You hear the message? The message is, when a person falls, don't give away everything else. No matter how bad it is, you might be left with almost nothing. He was left without his own identity. He wasn't left with his own personality. Doesn't even have that. When it says a stick, it means literally that. He didn't have himself. That's what he'd lost. In case you think, well, this rabbi is talking about interesting, you know, but no, that's not me. I've been through crises that he can't imagine. And I've been, you know, I've lost much more than that. Mental instability, mental breakdown. You think he hadn't been through that? He'd lost much more than that. There was an arch enemy who looked like him. Didn't bother him. Didn't bother him at all. Shlomo was Shlomo because that's who he was. So he retained what he had and it brought him back to greatness and us into the world. Give me one more example. One more example. And we'll leave it at that. The Gemara says that King Saul suffered the same experience, and you'll see how he dealt with it. King Saul, Shaul HaMelech. Can I keep you for 3 more minutes? I'm not offended if you wish to go. King Saul went through the same kind of experience. I'll make it short. This is what happened. He was ruler of the Jewish people before David became king, and he was a man who was destined to bring in the Messianic revelation. Before you say that, if he'd done correctly what he should have done, he would have brought in the Messianic revelation. He was from the tribe of Binyamin, whose job it is, the Mashiach ben Yosef, has to bring in the Messianic, the Mashiach ben David. He could have brought the world to an absolute Messianic perfection. And that, right then and there in his generation, how did he have to do it? He was given a command by Hashem to kill the people of Amalek. Amalek was the people who represented all evil and negativity in the world as a people, and therefore spiritually they were the core of all evil in the world. The final battle, it says, will be between us and Amalek. They are the pretenders to the spiritual crown, and they try and convince the world that there is no spiritual power, that what you see is what you get, and it's all a physical existence. That's Amalek. He was commanded to kill them. On a physical level, it means a battle and wipe them out, because they were very, very negative and evil people. But on a spiritual level, it means to wipe out all evil. Obviously, there's no place in the human, there's no human anymore in which evil can manifest, so then evil isn't in the world anymore. It disappears. So he knew, imagine that, Hashem had chosen him. He'd been given a mitzvah to actually bring the Messianic. He knew that's what it meant. He didn't think it was just a war for territory. There's no such thing. At least not here. It wasn't a war for a bit of territory or some kind of national prestige or some other nonsense. It was a war to bring the perfection of the world into revelation. So Hashem said, go and kill them. Kill all of them. The sheep even. The animals. Every last human among them. Wipe them out and you'll bring perfection to the world. Some mitzvahs are difficult, by the way. That's not an easy mitzvah. You have to kill somebody who looks human. Outwardly looks human. Not so simple. We're not given a chance to do that. We're not managing much less than that. That's what he had to do. What happened? King Saul went out to battle, and he killed them. But he left a few sheep alive, and he left the king Agag alive. That's all. One man. I'm not going into what reasons he did it for right now. He had reasons. We once gave a discussion. We once talked about that. We once went into detail about his whole calculation, why he did it, where he was similar to Adam. You can refer to that type to see the justification of such a great man for disobeying Hashem's will. But I'm not going into that now. But he left him alive. And he had some sheep in the mystical writings that says that the sheep weren't actually sheep. They were people of Amalek who had transmuted themselves into sheep. They were great sorcerers. And therefore, but I'm not going into that now. Again, for another time. The point is that he left Agag alive, the king. That night, Hashem appeared to Samuel, to Shmuel the prophet, and he said, I want you to go to Shaul tomorrow because he'd done a terrible thing. Shmuel came the next day and he saw that Saul had disobeyed Hashem. He had disobeyed Hashem. He was told to kill them all and he left one man alive. And by the way, that man was a disaster. Because Agag, what happened, briefly the story is, that the next morning when Shmuel came up to Saul and said, what have you done? So he said, well, I left one man alive. So Shmuel called for him, and when Agag appeared, he took a sword and he killed him on the spot. Shmuel killed Agag on the spot in front of the king's eyes. But night before, he had a relationship with a woman in the camp, and she was pregnant. And a child was born, so Amalek wasn't killed. And who was a descendant of that woman? Haman, who tried to kill the Jewish people. Of course, he was Amalek, and so it hasn't ended. That's what happened. because Saul didn't kill one man, so Amalek remained in the world and blossomed and multiplied itself, and that's who we're dealing with today. And that's what happened because of that. So he failed. Saul failed. He failed. He disobeyed Hashem directly, and he lost the future of the world. In his hands, again, you hear, we're talking big stakes. In his hand was the ability to bring the messianic revelation right there, and he blew it. He lost the opportunity. And in front of his eyes, Shmuel had to do the job for him in front of the Jewish people. And not only that, but as Shmuel turned to go, Shmuel said to him that you have lost the kingship. You've lost Hashem's favor. You are despised in Hashem's eyes. And Hashem is going to take the rule of the Jewish people and the world and give it to someone who's better than you, David. His arch rival, his arch enemy. He's going to give it to him. Could you imagine a worse sense of failure? You had nothing left. His whole the dynasty, the whole rulership of the world, again, had been torn away from him and from his son, not Yonasan. And he died a miserable, died in battle the next day, or shortly after that, died in battle with his son, Jonathan, Yonasan. And David was given the kingship. And as he turned to go, Shmuel said, you are despised from being Hashem's chosen messianic figure. And as Shmuel turned to go, Saul caught onto the hem of his garment, and he said, wait, stay with me. And the garment tore. The cloak tore, the piece tore off in his hand. And Shmuel turned to him and he said, just like that piece has been ripped off, that's how you've been torn out of the world. You've been torn out of the Jewish people just like that. Whole mystical story, what it means, the garment, and what means a corner being torn off. But that's what happened to him. So he was in the depth of misery. What did he do? Let's understand, what does a great man do in such a situation? Did he go to pieces? Did he lose his world? Did he curse Chas v'Shalom? Did he lose this world and the next? Oh no. Saul gathered himself together. Listen to this. This is greatness. This shows you what it means to be chosen to be a king of the Jewish people. The expected response in such a situation, and this connects with what we spoke about a week or two or 3 weeks ago about Nisayon, about ordeal. An ordeal brings out the miraculous. An ordeal brings out the miraculous in a human. Right? That's what it does. And here was Saul faced with an ordeal, the ultimate ordeal of his life, in which he had just failed and plummeted. What did he do? He gathered himself together. The expected response was, go to pieces, curse Chas v'Shalom, go out of this world and the next. He said to Shmuel, do me a favor, come with me. He took the prophet, and he said, look, I know what's happened. I know I've failed. I know I've lost more than anybody can imagine, much more than anybody. But I want you to come with me. And in front of the Jewish people, I want to bow down to Hashem. I want to acknowledge Hashem's rule in the world. I want you to be seen with me. I want the Jewish people to see that that's what I'm doing. And Shmuel understood. And he went with him. And Saul worshipped Hashem. He bowed down to Hashem. He did what he should have done in that situation. Exactly as a faithful servant. It's all he had left. He had nothing left. He wasn't the king anymore. He was torn away. What did he have left? All he had left was one act of obeisance. That's all. Just one small act to show who he was. That's all. But he did it. Instead of collapsing, anybody else on earth would have collapsed in shame, at least disappeared in shame, and hidden from all human eyes. He didn't do that. He went and faced the people, and he had the last act that he could do as a human being, he did that. That's all. What did he have left? But he ruled over what he had left, and he did that. And it says he went home to Gibeah Shaul, and Shmuel went back to his place, and it says that Saul and Jonathan entered the next world. They were sharing the next world. They were killed in battle by the Philistines, they entered the next world. What you have to understand from these stories is this. What a Jew has to expect in life is failure. That's what you have to expect. You don't expect it, you have to experience it, because that's what we're doing. Right? None of us are achieving anything like even a beginning of what we should be achieving. Nothing. Not even faintly. And not only that, but it's going to get worse. It's going to get much worse. And each of us is going to be faced, we are being faced, we will be faced definitely with terrible experiences. Unfortunately. Lo yalein, it shouldn't happen. But that seems to be the pathway. Ordeals of emunah, of faith, of belief. Ordeals of being human. Certainly ordeals of expressing who it is we're supposed to be in the world. That's the biggest of them all, that nobody's even beginning to think about. Who even wakes up in the morning and thinks about what it is I'm supposed to be? Most of us, if not all of us, are very happy if we get through a day just coping. If today just isn't worse than yesterday, we are very thankful at the end of the day. Well, when do you start living? When do you start putting out who it is you're supposed to be? You're here for something. You have to do a job. You have to bring messianic revelation in the world, no less than that. Follow the Jewish people, that's what you're here for. You're not here just to cope. If you cope with today, that's called failing. It's not what you're here for. You even think about that? That's what we're doing right now. So, and it's much worse than that. So we have to know that when that happens, but whatever you have left, rule over that. Whatever you have left, you have a little shred of dignity. So your life has collapsed. Everyone's against you. Those who should be closest have turned against you. That's the way it usually is. That's not unusual, that's the way it usually is. The one who should be the closest has turned against you. That's where the greatest bitterness is. And everybody else has gone that way. And at the same time, your health has failed. You've got nothing left at all and you're being despised. That's where Jew begins. It's not where you give up. That's where you begin. You pick up the little pieces that are left. And you relate to those pieces. What does Hashem want from you in that situation? People have asked me so many times, what do you mean facing an ordeal? What if you can't face the ordeal? What if you're just managing to cope? What if you're doing the best you can? Doing the best you can? If you're doing the best you can, that's called victory. Doing the best you can doesn't mean climbing back to what you think perfection is. Doing the best you can means doing with the situation that's given to you the best that you can do. And in the worst situation, you can reach greatness. You can become part of Torah in the worst situation. You can be crashing from the pinnacle of the heights of the world, which I'm sure is not happening to you, into the depth of the lowest place that the world has to offer. And in that moment, you can write a chapter in Tanakh. In that moment of torture and panic, you could write a chapter of Tanakh. You could become a Shlomo, a Shol. And it will be written. That book's been written. It isn't only what's in those books, in those words. When the final story is unfolded and the book's read, you're going to be there forever. So you can't afford. And if you've been given that ordeal, being considered strong enough to bear it. That's what we have to do. That is what a Jew is. That's the task of the Jewish people. Now, by Yitzhak Shem, always there to use this message and to try and use these opportunities, whatever they may be, whichever kind of a deal we're in, to bring about at least our own personal messianic light and Yitzhak Shem, Mashiach in general.